I give a class, ongoing class here at Holden called Making Your Congregation a Creation Awareness Center. Part of the idea is that we've somehow in our world, in our busy worlds in 1991, United States of America, we've gotten away from the idea that we are stewards of God's creation, and that everything our hands touch, we're responsible for, that we have, it's from the first chapter of the Bible to the last chapter. The Bible tells us that that we're here for a reason, and one of the things that we're supposed to be doing is taking care of the planet, that we're stewards of it, entrusted to care of the planet, so future generations also have a home. In Genesis 1, at the end of every day, God says, God saw what God made and said, it is good. God blessed the creation just as God blessed us. And in the very last chapter in Revelation, we hear again that creation is good in and of itself, and that part of the promise of Jesus Christ is that all of creation will be redeemed, and that in the end times, there will be a new creation. But some scholars look at Revelation and they see a mandate that we're supposed to take care of the earth until Jesus comes again. That's another idea. What is Christian ecology? I like something that Calvin DeWitt is a professor in Wisconsin. And I really wish I would have found this paragraph before I started talking about him. This is a good journal called Firmament. It started in 1988, and it's done by the North American Conference on Christianity and Ecology. And in it, he talks about that that we have the scriptures, that we have spirituality, and we have each other to tell us. We have other Christians, and we have the community of faith and the Christian church to help us learn how we are to be. This is another really good resource. Rudy Edmond has been coming here to Holden for years and years. A lot of you probably have met him. He used to teach at California Lutheran University. And he's been working on this for a little while, and we're now publishing it here at Holden. It's called Managing God's Creation. And it's about a five-part, there's four chapters in it. And I've read the first two so far. It's just hot off the presses. And I'd really recommend you take a copy of it home with you. He's really done a fine job, and he really stresses stewardship strongly, like someone with his experience can. Rudy's been a good steward of his life, and he's really benefited California Lutheran University and Holden Village and all the people that he's come across. I'd really recommend it.
Is that in the bookstore?
It's across the street in the bookstore. Yeah, only $3.95. Another really good book, Joseph Sittler's Gravity and Grace, and I'll get to it in just a minute.
I have that.
Yeah.
I like Sittler.
Yeah.
It's Sittler, isn't it?
Joseph Sittler.
Yeah.
My favorite Lutheran theologian.
Yeah,
Joseph Sittler was one of the few people talking about, one of the few American Protestant mainline theologians that was talking about the environment. He was talking about it through his entire career while he was writing. He was talking about nature and grace. And he really stressed it in the 60s and up to the time he died a few years ago. Well, let's take a look at these sheets, Creation Awareness Bible Study. We start this text study of our role in creation in the beginning. And I use the command tense here, study in depth, Genesis 1 through 3. Creation, you want to take this one here? Now, what these are here are something else. If you want to later, I brought these down, and It's called On Living Towards the Future, Responses to the Natural World, what the natural world is telling us. And basically what it is, we have for 20 months had a visiting scholar, Al Pitcher, Jr., and he read all the lists, the 1001, the book of 750 different things you can do, the 50 simple things you can do, and he compiled them, and so here's a succinct list that it's pretty good. And for we suggest that you have 10 cents a page donation. So for 30 cents, it's a really good deal. For free, it's even better. But suggested donation. Let's open our Bibles to Genesis 1. Who needs a Bible? Anyone else want a Bible? Would someone like to read Genesis 1, 26 through 28? No, let's go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah. I really had the door just open so it'd warm up a little bit. It's kind of cool in here.
26, 28?
Uh-huh.
Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth.
This text is a good place to start. It's influenced our thinking about the natural world and our place in it. I know that my stepmother told me a couple years ago in a discussion that she believed that everything was here meant for us to use. And I thought about that for a while. And my question was, well, who's us? You know, if this earth has finite resources, and I think, you know, about everything material is finite, isn't this supposed to be everyone's for a long, long, long time? If there's the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago has a calendar that's going backwards. It has a clock going backwards, and when they started it off, it started off at 40 years, and it's now at about 36 years or something. And it's supposed to be the supply of oil. Okay, so if we've got, at the rate we're using it, when they set that, and of course we haven't cut back at all, you know, we're using about twice as much oil as we were using in the 70s when OPEC came on. We cut back for just a little bit, but then we just motored ahead, pedal to the metal. We're using more oil than ever. Anyway, you know, we're not leaving any for the next generation. We're gonna use it up. Now, part of that is our trust in technology, that we figure, well, you know, we'll have something else, okay? But what if they find, they start making drugs from oil or something? You know, they make a cure for cancer from oil, and it takes a lot of it. Then we're just out of luck. Good. I talked about this the other day. When they clear cut, they're mainly going after one or two types of wood. And usually what they do, well, when they clear cut, they cut down every tree and they burn that they don't want, because they don't want those trees growing back. And then they go in and plant what they want to come back and harvest. So one of the trees that they were cutting down and burning were the yew trees. And now they found that there's a cure for cancer from the bark of the yew tree. But those yew trees are gone. And so now the timber companies want special variances to get into areas that have been closed by orders of the judges while further studies are being done. They want to get in there to cut this yew tree. They're saying, no, we need this drug right now. We want to get in there and get those yew trees. But I think that they should have thought about that earlier. But they didn't have that information earlier.
They didn't know that.
Yeah, but that is a good example of how we sort of just in an arrogant way have been plowing through. We've just been sort of, you know, what happened to our forest? You know, when the people landed on the Atlantic, a great percentage of this country was forest, except for the plains. Most of this country was forest. And, we cut down the forests in New England. Then we cut down the forests in Wisconsin and Michigan. And we cut down the full forest in Georgia. And now we're working our way, and we're working on the forest up in Alaska now. And now they're going to start working on the forest in Siberia. I don't know. There's a lot of tough questions involved around forestry. I spent the last year in Oregon. And it really is an issue there of jobs and families versus the environment. And there's no easy answer.
Part of this thing about the question or the comment that your mother made, my father used to make that statement too, the same statement. But we go to the having dominion. Well, my interpretation of that is to mean that, yes, these resources are for us to use, but we must manage them to the best of our ability.
Right.
And I feel that some of these companies, such as these lumber companies, are not managing the best, or Japan with these clear-cutting the rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that that's not good management.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what we're driving at here.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, you know, Japan is clear-cutting the forests of Malaysia and Borneo, and they cut down these old-growth trees, these beautiful, huge trees, to make plywood or concrete forms.
They themselves have law not to cut their trees.
Yeah.
They have trees in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. But we have to be careful when we're talking about other countries. We can talk best about ourselves.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, there are several verbs in this sentence. If you look at 26 through 28, it's have dominion, subdue. What else do we have there? Be fruitful, multiply, or am I getting ahead of myself? Okay. I asked, we had a Hebrew scholar here, Peter Nash from Garrett in Chicago, and I asked him about doing a little word study real quickly on dominion, and we looked it up, and when it, half the time it's, well, usually it's used in a, not in a military sense, but in a, with the king. And the idea in the Bible, when we're writing about kings and we're writing well about them, we talk about the king as a servant. As a servant. And I know a pastor in Portland that I did a presentation with at our Senate Assembly last June. He opened up with a short sermon, and he used for his text this Genesis, and then in Matthew, where around 20, where Jesus, well, you know the story about the mother of James. What is it? Well, the two disciples that she asked, let me ask you a favor, you know, when you come into your power, would you put one of my sons on one hand and one on the other? Mm-hmm. Very good. What does he say? He said, oh, brother. No, go ahead. Now, in there, I mean, Jesus gives a description of what is to be our attitude towards Christian action, and that we're to be servants. We're called to be a servant church. We are always in temptation to not want to do that. I mean, that's not what we want to do. You know, we want to You know, there's always the temptation to pride. There's always the temptation to having it easy.
I think our society puts over us, you know, take care of yourself.
Yeah.
The me and I society, there's a lot of that out there.
Yeah. Well, that's what Jesus is talking about. He's talking about his society you know, all around. He was talking about all around, and this is what, you know, this is what the world's doing. The world has rulers who, you know, they push people around and tell you what to do. And he's telling, you know, this is what you think you're going to do in the kingdom too. You're not getting it, what I've been preaching to you about. He says, you will not do that. You will be a servant. So in this short sermon that I was talking about, he paired these two texts. But to have dominion, wait a minute, Jesus came and said, this is how you lord over things. You lord over things by being a servant. And, another one of the questions I want to ask about this text in the first chapter of Genesis is what do you think it means if it starts off with, let us make humankind in our image according to our likeness and let them have dominion. What does it mean to be in God's image? Let's discuss that for a minute.
Try to be like him.
Right. In what way do you think, specifically, because we've just been given a little bit of information so far about God, though this, you know, message came to people, God's people that already knew some, but coming early in the book like this, with what's been happened so far, how are we to be like God?
Loving, caring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people don't get to that point right away. I think to be made in God's image, what a lot of people will, their first thoughts are that, well, we have souls. God gave us a soul so we could be in God's image. And that's part of it. And that we have reason. We have reason. But those are sort of our sort of physical and spiritual characteristics. I think, though, that so far in Genesis 1, we have a powerful story about God, the Creator, and it's about God's actions, not describing much more than that so far. You know, God's done this. And I think that's what it's talking about, that we're supposed to care for each other. I use the title Creation Awareness for this particular focus of my theological, my faith life. But, I mean, it could have a lot of different names. But I just think that we've gotten away from the idea of caring for creation. Caring for creation. Let's go on.
Actually, creation is not just nature out there. It's the people in it, too. I think we are the creative being that God created. I'm sure you mean that, too, but it hasn't been said.
Yeah.
I have a feeling you're talking about the nature.
Yeah. You have to be really careful to stress this point. I see that when you care for another person, when you show your love to another person, or when you show even, you know, your discipline and self-control and exhort, you know, mutual consolation, whatever, how you interact with other Christians is part of caring for creation. One of the points that Joseph Sittler makes is that we are at all, that this description of humanity and how we came to be in Genesis 1 through 3, including this first story. You know, there's two creation stories in Genesis 1 through 3, with the second one starting about chapter 2, verse 4. And especially the second story. This is a very rich story with a lot of meaning. But I think one of the things that's so important to me and my general understanding that I carry with me every day, and that Joseph Sittler points out, that this story teaches us that we're at all times in three relationships. Okay, first, God created Adam. So we have this relationship between human being and God. God and human being. And then God created another person, because it says that first God made some more animals, and that there might be a helper among them, but there wasn't, and that this person needed a helper and a partner. So God created another person. Okay, that's the second relationship, that we are at all times in relationship with other people. And that God did not create Adam and Eve and bring them down and put them on earth. Or they didn't live somewhere else and they sinned and were put on earth. But God created Adam out of the earth, put him in the garden, and gave him a command to till and to keep it. But that's the third relationship, is that we have a relationship with the rest of creation, with the land, with the animals, with everything. So those three relationships at all times, God and human being to human being, and human being to creation. Any questions, any comments?
Another part of that being created in God's image, I feel, is the ability to choose right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's the moral.
Yes.
The moral side.
He gives us that choice.
Yeah.
That's the third. Mm-hmm. That's the third facet of the image of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have the ability to do that. We have the ability to do that. Let's look. Does anyone else have anything to say about the first part of this Bible study?
Just that dominion.
What about dominion?
Well, too many people interpret that to mean domineering.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not at all what the verb there is intended to imply.
Mm-hmm.
What it's intended to imply is managerial,
right,
status of the human being over against all of creation. We have forgotten that.
Right.
We manage it, sure, but we manage it for our benefit.
Right.
For our profit. This is so glaringly apparent in our world today and in the United States. Mm. The average, almost the average businessman will look at it from the standpoint of, what's in it for me?
Yeah.
I'll go along with this economy if it means a profit to me.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't cost me anything.
Or it doesn't cost me anything.
Yeah.
So, of course, that's why they're cutting down the trees. It's my profit.
Mm-hmm.
It's my profit.
Yeah. And
when the government steps in and says you have to replant trees, they take exception to that.
Uh-huh. We have to spend some of our profit to replant. Right.
Well, businesses are geared towards being short-sighted. You know, they've got a fiscal year, and even less than that. And these are the pressures put on the people to be in business. You have to perform. You know, I mean, people aren't given, if you're brought in as a troubleshooter into some company, you aren't given 20 years to turn things around. Do it immediately. And we've just been behaving short-sightedly. Now, a lot of that is, you know, we didn't know. We really didn't know. Just 100 years ago, the timber people that came out here, they couldn't even imagine that we could cut down all these forests. Couldn't even imagine it. But couldn't imagine the world population boom, the need for supplies to the housing boom after World War II. If we can look back and we see things in the timber industry, there were people telling them in the 30s and 40s, you're not planting. You're not planting. And you're going to cut down all the trees before the next generation comes around. And there's not that many second growth forests that are ready for to be harvested again.
I think in so many cases, the livelihood of a family depends on a certain job. And it takes an enormous amount of courage, maybe, if possible, to change their vocation or their job. And how many people would do this? It reminds me of the Second World War, where my father was a very outspoken man, and my mother always saying, oh, don't say anymore, you know, because we depended on him. Mm-hmm. And maybe if more German earlier on had spoken out, but, you know, it isn't that simple.
Yeah.
Because we knew what would follow. And I can see a big relationship in that. Mm-hmm. With people who are now in the lumber industry, they feel very different about it. You know, they're losing their jobs in Washington and Oregon, as you know, too. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been in their shoes, but I can feel for them. It isn't all that simple.
And they don't have a whole lot of choices.
No.
And a lot of, what the feeling of a lot of the workers, especially men that are 40, 50 years old, is, you know, what are they going to be retrained for? Because a lot of these people are second, third generation lumber people, and a lot of them quit going to school, eighth, ninth grade, because they knew they're going to be working in the forest their whole life. Turns out that that's not the way it is. There's going to be some cutbacks. They already were experiencing, well, for one thing, timber work is seasonal as it is. Both the people that harvest the trees and the work in the mills. And they're used to layoffs and stuff. It's sort of like construction work. That's just part of it. You make pretty good money while you're working, but you have to be careful because sometimes you won't be working. It's always been really dangerous work. I mean, timber work is probably the most dangerous work in the world. You see, seen footage of these guys walking the logs down the river. You know, they used to take get the logs down to the mill by the river. I couldn't imagine anything more dangerous than that. It's just amazing. But now, there are going to be, okay, just in the last 2 years, because of the recession, because housing starts were way down, there were already huge amounts of layoffs. You know, I'd pick up the paper and they say something like 3,500 people expect to be laid off that month. And that's before the spotted owl thing. And now, the judge in Seattle that's put a moratorium on cutting in certain federal lands. You know, that when that happened, that hadn't really impacted yet. All the layoffs that had happened so far were just due to the recession. So, you know, there's trouble. A study I saw, I was on a church task force on timber, the timber dependent communities, the economies. And there's at least 70 communities in Oregon that are known to be at risk. And that means that, I mean, the town will just shut their doors. And then some wealthy people come along later and buy up the homes and turn it into a resort area or something.
And it's not just the foresters, it's all the other businesses that build around it.
Right. Sure. Right.
I was going to say that my nieces are married to foresters in California. That means forester, not just somebody who's not a logger, but I mean a forester.
Forest Service?
They're registered foresters.
For growing trees and managing forests for
private
lands.
Managing, and they're just horrified as to what Weyerhaeuser has done to Washington and Oregon, that finally California wised up. And they could never do the things down there that Weyerhaeuser has done to our forests here and in Oregon.
Yeah.
And that all this, as if that makes up for the travesty of what they've done already, is just so horrible that, I mean, most of us don't know anything about it.
I've got a newspaper in the Resource Center that shows a picture of the land around Olympic National National Park. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you cannot cut timber in national parks, but national forests are managed by the Department of Agriculture for the foresters. I mean, for the private companies. It somehow turned into that. And we spend, one of the things that environmentalists push is that we spend tax money building roads into these areas so these people can cut the trees down, and we don't get anything back from that. It's just, we spent millions of dollars doing the work for the timber companies. But anyway, these pictures, they're just for me. I mean, they're just heartbreaking, and that's how most people feel. And it's just sort of a naive attitude. But you see these pictures of, well, this one I'm thinking of in particular, of the land leading up to the national park. It's clear-cut, valley, 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 and then the park. And you can just imagine how large each one of those valleys is, and that every tree is gone. And that they're not, in the past, they're saying that they're going to be more careful. But you take a northern exposure at a steep angle, and you clear-cut that, and it may be nothing will grow back. Because the way those trees have always grown, they've always been in a sheltered environment. And with a stable temperature, fairly stable temperature, and a fairly stable, fairly stable temperature, and an amount of light and all. And all of a sudden, it's a harsh, very alpine setting, and where it was a moderate climate before. Oh, the old growth forests are really unique. Has everyone, anyone here, has, how many people have gone hiking in an old growth forest?
I was just there, truly.
We need to move on. I should do a session on forestry. let's go through the sheet all the way through, and maybe we can decide what we want to talk about in the remaining 20 minutes. The next important part, I think, is Genesis 9. What's significant there is that God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you shall rest on every animal of the earth and on every bird of the air, on everything that creeps on the ground, and on all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered." Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "As for me, I am establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the domestic animals, and every animal of the earth with you, as many came out of the ark." And it says, and with the earth itself. It mentions the earth specifically. And I just think that that's... just a real eye opener for me when I read it that I am in a covenant. We talk about one of the ideas that environmentalists want to hold up is the interrelatedness of all life, and we surely know that that's true. And here it is, explicitly stated, in a biblical covenant. In a biblical covenant, and I see this covenant as a sign of hope too. Because some of the Old Testament covenants are, there'll be some action that the covenant hinges upon, that we are told to do something. And this is the covenant that, of course, God made after the flood. And God tells us that we're in this covenant and doesn't say, you know, how... if you do such and such a thing, you know, then you're in trouble. So I see that as a sign of hope. Next, we're moving on in Exodus. I say, study the Ten Commandments and reflect on how disobeying God's will leads to environmental degradation. Note, you shall not steal, murder, covet. Do people, corporations, governments covet, steal and murder by misusing resources?
Yes.
You sounded pretty sure of that.
I certainly am. I think at first we should start with the federal government.
With the federal government?
Yes, with the misuse of funds. And the same way of saving our environment. We remember that this Mr. Watts wanted to give all of our Park Service away so that the lumbermen could come in and take the trees, and it had to be stopped. Mm-hmm. The misuse of funds is going on in every department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the lumberians too, Georgia Pacific, Weyerhaeuser, any of them. You know what they, my brother-in-law went to Japan to build a paper, I mean, a, construct a building for pulp mill so that they can make plywood much cheaper. They sent ships over there to Japan and sent, made plywood, then sent it back to America rather than keeping it here in the States.
Yeah. That's one of the laws that has been changed in the last year.
But then that...
About exporting whole logs.
Yeah, that's what, yes, but that was about 15 years, 20 years ago that he did that. Yeah. That made me angry. But also, I think first we need to start with our federal government.
Well, I think first...
There's a breed there.
Yeah, I think first we have to start with ourselves. I think that... but I know what you mean. Mm-hmm. But I think we want to be careful about... See, there's people, when people talk about social change, they talk about... coming from the ground up or from the top down. And with saving the earth, and that's saving the earth for future generations, for human sustainability. The teachers that say save the earth don't tell the whole picture, tell the whole story, because of course what we're talking about is saving the earth for people. We're not talking about saving the earth for the earth. You know, the earth is going to be here, you know, after a nuclear war, after whatever, the earth will be here, and it'll have some sort of plant life, and it'll have some sort of animal life, but will it have human beings? The State of the World is a book that comes out every year, done by the World Watch Institute, and they came out in 1989 saying that we've got 40 years to turn it around. 40 years to turn it around. And if we don't do it, by then it'll be a lost cause. It'll...
I would imagine we have much more money available now. That the threat of communism is gone. Who's our enemy? We don't really have an enemy anymore. Well, what are we going to do with all our stuff? Because we need to turn that around.
I know.
It speaks and has a lot of power.
Maybe now we'll really have a peace dividend.
Yeah.
You know?
We don't realize that the enemy is us.
Yeah. We, like Pogo says, yeah, huh? Yeah. We have seen the enemy, and the enemy is us. But, so anyway, you know, top down and bottom up.
That's right. I was looking at a small group of people. This is the beginning, and we need to reach out.
Mm-hmm. What was it? What did you say?
I was looking at the small group of
people. Oh, this small group, yeah.
And how we believe in the environment, yeah, and saving the environment.
Yeah.
You say start at the bottom. But we not only, you, but all of us should reach out then.
Right, right. I have the sheets on making your congregation a creation awareness center. The church has a creation awareness center. And I talk about, that's a session that I'll do on Friday, I think it is, or on Thursday. And talking about it. It's so important, you know, that we together as a church work together. David Brower, who was big in the Sierra Club and then founded the Earth Island Institute, issued a call to the churches saying that that this problem is so large, you know, we need everyone to work together. But he was calling on the churches in particular because we are a caring community and because we're the best, he calls the churches the best organized sector of Western civilization. You may not think of ourselves as that, because especially if you're involved in a congregation, you might see all the how hard it is to get anything done.
And this is not as political, I would think. I mean, this is really in the Bible for us, to
yeah,
be good stewards. I don't think anybody can object to this, because often it's a political issue. Oh,
yeah.
No, we don't want, you know, that's,
yeah,
we don't want to deal with that.
But what it comes down to is things like the woman here that this morning, you know, was telling me that she decided that when she came here, she was a little bit angry over people in her church wanted to put in a big central air conditioning system. And she says, you know, we've got this, you know, real high ceiling, and the sanctuary itself, maybe two Sundays a year, is it really just too warm? And why should we spend all this money for two Sundays a year? Later on, I think on Saturday, I'm going to talk about lifestyle. And has everyone heard the expression deep ecology? What deep ecology is people that have decided that it is very important to them and that they're going to make radical changes in their lifestyle, and they're going to quit using as many resources. And so three things that would, that is sort of a, well, that someone, you know, that wanted to be involved in Deep Ecology would do, would be, one would be to get rid of your car. You know, I would ask you, that was a cry of panic.
I always used to say, next to my husband in sewing machines, a car comes.
Yeah.
You can't yeah. mention that my priorities yeah. are.
But you can see, no, you can see for a lot of people, that's not even a consideration.
Well, it depends upon what kind of car. I mean, you can make it.
No, no, I'm talking about Deep Ecology here. I'm not talking about being an environmentalist. I'm talking about what some people decided, I said, make radical changes. I said, just get rid of the car. Now, I myself, I can do that. You know, I'm a single person living in a city. I don't need a car. Where I'm, I go back.
Would be the next, probably.
Yeah, right, right. And that, and yeah, I'm healthy. Okay? But where I'm, I go back to my final year at school at seminary in the south side of Chicago, and it's a liability for me to have a car. The only reason I want to have that car is to go to the grocery store and to go out for entertainment in the evening, because traveling on the public transit at night is not really safe. Okay? But, you know, I could still, I have plenty of friends that have cars that would like to go to the places I want to go to. Then I don't have to pay, if I don't have a car, I don't have to pay insurance. I don't have to do this, I don't have to do that. I went to my internship site without a car, and the first Sunday I was there, someone donated $1,000 so the intern would have a car, because that was unthinkable to them, that the intern would not have a car. So, I still rode my bicycle to church most days, but I've got a car, and then I had to make a decision, well, do I want this car? Because they offered it to me, and I could buy it, and it was a really, really good price. And I thought about it a lot for months, and I decided I went ahead and bought the car. Because as it was a nice little Renault LeCar, gets pretty good gas mileage, and I had to get back to Chicago somehow and all. But I would much rather really take the Amtrak. I'd really, if you're gonna visit Holden, and you could just take the Amtrak. I mean, if you're in some place like Chicago or Milwaukee or St. Paul, it's the easiest thing in the world to take the train out. You just have someone drop you off at the train station.
In your car.
Yeah. Okay, walk to the train station. Yeah. Okay, so one thing is get rid of your car. Okay, now in the actions here, like here's 140 different things to do. You know, your life is full of choices. You'll make 100 choices even during the day, even while you're in some place like Holden. And this will cut back your choices, you know. But you still need to make all kinds of choices. Am I going to do this? Am I going to do that? Now, you know, I urge you, you know, to make reasoned choices. And if you get in a small group, like I urge people to start a small group in your church to talk about the environment. And out of your discussions with people, you know, you sort of reason your action. And that's important to do that in the actions that your church is going to take, your congregation is going to take. But in your personal life, you know, talk over your decisions with friends and get different points of view. But so I would urge you to do what I do when I have a car is there's days when I get a big kick out of just leaving the car there. You know, don't even start it. You know, I mean, if you don't need to start the car that day, don't. You know, some days it's pretty easy. You know, if you're going to go downtown, get on the bus, you know, then you don't have to worry about finding a parking place or whatever. If you work someplace, you know, and there's, it's really inconvenient to take public transportation, you might need to drive, but you also might carpool. You might carpool. So there's a lot of different choices. Now the other things that would be the radical things, like don't have a car. The other one would be to quit eating meat. You don't need meat. There are all kinds of sources for protein, and you'll be better off. Okay? Now that's a radical thing, to quit
it's
eating
right.
meat.
It's radical.
Okay?
The farmer's going to holler.
Well, farmers grow other things besides beef and besides pork.
Well, they put a lot of money out of it.
Okay, now there's...
Everything on this earth is for man to use.
Okay.
That's right. It's what you're to use.
So, but we've grown a lot of cows. I don't think there were so many cows a long time ago. We got a lot of cows now. But anyway, so what I would think that what most people could do would be to eat less meat. To eat less meat. I know that on my table, when I grew up, we had meat at almost every meal, and certainly at every lunch and dinner. And usually when I'd come home and I'd ask my mom, what's for dinner? She'd say, chicken. She'd say, roast beef. You know, the vegetables didn't even get a mention. You know, that's what the meal was built around, meat. And in the last couple of years, I've just been, I'll have meat in something, but I don't eat very many large cuts of meat. I don't buy roasts and things like that. And now I'm much more, I'm becoming a vegetarian, but my heart's not in it. I'm just a political vegetarian.
I can't quite see the connection with less meat improving the environment.
Okay, well, I've got a sheet for you then.
I can't.
At the east end of the dining hall, Al wrote a front and back side, give you all kinds of good reasons on why to eat less meat. Like little things like a pound of hamburger, so much, you know, something like 2,000 gallons goes into having a pound of hamburger. 2,000 gallons of water goes into producing a pound of hamburger. It takes 19 times the amount of soybeans or grains to produce that meat as to if we would just eat the grains. It's very inefficient. We feed 19 pounds of grain to that animal to have it come back to 1 pound of meat. Now, for us in our world today, there's no one telling us not to eat meat. People are telling you to eat meat. Ranchers, the Ranchers Association and everything. I mean, I grew up in Kansas. I remember, you know, I'm used to going down the highway and seeing these billboards, you know, with the nice juicy steak saying, eat more meat. You go to the grocery store, eat more meat. But you know, that isn't the way it is around the rest of the world. In Mexico, people are lucky to have beans with their tortillas. Sometimes they just have tortillas and sometimes they just have beans. We have the luxury of meat. And I'm saying that it's a luxury, it's not a necessity, and for a lot of people it's bad on their health. Right, the body is temple, and Paul talks about that in 2 Corinthians, and well, maybe 1 Corinthians also. Those are the good comments. I did a summer hospital chaplaincy a couple of years ago in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and that's part of the country that has great food. But the habits there, the German immigrants, they eat a very rich diet, a lot of butter, a lot of cream. And I would get lists of patients to go visit, and I would walk in the room, and I could almost guess by what that person was in there for, you know, what that person was going to look like when I got in there. You know, and you have a bunch of very heavy people, and they're in there for guess what? The heart. It's just, you know, what we have in hospitals now is chronic health conditions. Around the turn of the century, hospitals were filled with people that had diseases, infectious diseases. But now, the hospitals are still full, but we've wiped out the diseases. But what we have to work on is lifestyle. That we, because we can, we live well. You know, we're not going to get through this list. I was sure I was going to make it to the New Testament today.
Someplace in the Bible, God does list a lot of the things that we should eat.
Mm-hmm.
But seeds and
yeah, wheat. But that's sort of problematic because a lot of the laws in the Old Testament really were common sense. Recommendations for the people at the time. You know, if you lived in the desert and you didn't have refrigeration, it's probably a really bad idea to eat shrimp. It says don't eat shellfish. Mm-hmm. And don't eat pork. We know that that pork spoils more so than...
Shellfish is high in cholesterol.
I don't think they knew. Well, maybe they knew about that.
God knew it.
God knew it. Let me, in the last couple of minutes, just go through the sheet. Let's look at page 2. In Deuteronomy and Leviticus, we have the different covenant forms telling us that we're to care for the land, just as the day, the week is 6 days you work, and on Sunday you rest, you are only to plant on the land for 6 years and then let it lie fallow, and that after seven Sabbaths go by, it's the year of Jubilee every 50 years, and if the family has lost their land, it is to revert back to the family. And that it goes on to say that the land is not ours, that we're tenants. You know, we think of that we own the land, or the bank does, or whatever. You know, we pay money for it, we pay taxes on it. But the Bible tells us that the land belongs to God. Next important part is the Psalms. And the Psalms are just full of inspirational messages about all of creation and our role in creation. And I just love myself. I love the statements like, the heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims God's handiwork. That's an idea that's in the Bible several times, that we can tell about God by nature. You know, you have to be real clear. I think that as a Christian, I want to be really clear about when I talk about observing God in nature, and that in nature I come to know God, and that I experience God's goodness out in the wilderness. But be real careful, you know, that I don't worship nature, because there's a lot of that popping up around. Ron Sider did a session here a couple weeks ago, and he says it's the ancient heresy of monism, of finding God in everything. But it's a subtle difference than, you know, someone as upright as Martin Luther makes statements like, the gospel is not only in the Bible, it is in the sky and the clouds and in the trees and the flowers. It's the idea of pantheism is God everywhere, but panentheism is God in everything. And panentheism is Orthodox Christian theology. But there's a subtle difference there between you move from panentheism to monism, where you find God everywhere. And that God is in... We say that God dwells within us. But if there's a subtle difference there in between that you worship the God, you know, that you're a God. God dwells in you, but you're not a God. That sort of thing. So the Psalms, and then we move into Isaiah, has some shaking things to say. Look at Isaiah 24:5. The earth lies polluted under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. It's sort of a startling thing to find out that pollution is not just our problem. It's not a modern problem. They've known about pollution for a long time. And you go through the book of Amos, it talks about, Amos is this rural, rustic type that goes up to Israel and denounces the rich in Israel for their taking the land away from the poor. It's a beautiful line there. He says, one translation says, you pant after the dust on their heads. And that sounds really strange, but what he's saying is, you want their land so bad, you even want the dust off their bodies. Then we get into the New Testament, and I think a real important idea is that we're not to be anxious. We're not to store up treasure. You need to take care of yourself. If you don't build up security for yourself, then that's not fair to other people, because then someone will have to take care of you. So it's not wrong to be frugal and save your money and all, but there's a line that you cross where you're just acquisitive and over-acquisitive and become fixated on it. We call it greed. It's nothing new about it. But Jesus came with a different message, and Jesus said, don't be anxious about tomorrow. Tomorrow can worry for itself. Don't be anxious. Look at the lilies of the field. Why do you care about your beautiful clothing? You can't get more beautiful than the lily. And doesn't God care for the birds? Surely God cares for you more than that, Jesus says. And then in Romans, you know, Paul writes about more about, you know, we can tell from God's creation a lot about God. So that the people that didn't know about God still were able to tell the difference between good and bad. And then in Romans 8:19, it talks about the hope of restoration, that all of everything is going to be redeemed in Jesus Christ. And a really important for me is Colossians 1:15-20. Jesus Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him.